A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars Shatterpoint by Matthew Woodring Stover. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. From the private journals of Mace Windu. In my dreams, I always do it right. In my dreams, I'm on the arena balcony, Geonosis. In my dreams, the purple flare of my blade sizzles the gray hairs of Dooku's beard. And in the critical semi-second it takes Jango Fett to aim and fire, I twitch that blade and take Dooku with me into death. And save the galaxy from civil war. I could have done it. I could have done it. Because I knew. I could feel it. In the swirl of the Force around me, I could feel the connections Dooku had forged between Jango and the Trade Federation, the Geonosians, the whole separatist movement. Connections of greed and fear, of deception and bald intimidation. Dooku was the shatter point. I knew it. That is my gift. Imagine a Coruscant gem. A mineral whose interlocking crystalline structure makes it harder than Durasteel. You can strike one with a 5-kilo hammer and do no more than dent the hammer's face. Yet, that same crystalline structure which gives the Coruscant strength also gives it shatter points. Spots where a precise application of carefully measured force, no more than a gentle tap, will break it into pieces. I can see shatter points. The sense is not sight, but see is the closest word Basic has for it. It is a perception, a feel of how what I look upon fits into the force and how the force binds it to itself and to everything else. Put simply, when I look at you through the Force, I can see where you break. Situations have shatter points, like gems. But those of situations are fluid, ephemeral, appearing for a bare instant, vanishing again to leave no trace of their existence. They are always a function of timing. There is no such thing as a second chance. Mace Windu stopped in the doorway and tried to recover his Jedi calm. An arc of sweat darkened the cowl of his robe, and his tunic clung to his skin. He'd come straight from a training bout at the temple without taking time to shower. And the brisk pace, almost a jog, he'd maintained through the labyrinth of the Galactic Senate had offered no chance for him to cool off. Palpatine's private office, in the center of the Supreme Chancellor's suite beneath the Senate's great rotunda, opened before him. Vast and stark. Within was only Yoda, alone, perched solemnly on his hover chair, hands folded around the head of his stick.
On time you are, the ancient master observed. But barely. Take a chair. Composed we must be. Serious, I fear this is.
I wasn't expecting a party. Mace's boot heels clacked on the polished floor. The courier said this is about the operation on Harun Kal. And the fact that of all the Jedi Council and the Republic High Command, only the two senior members of the Council had been summoned by the Chancellor, implied that the news was not good.
But it is not the planet Harun Kal that brings you in a sweat to this office, Yoda said. Concerned for Deepa you are.
Mace lowered his head. I know. The Force will bring what it will. But Republic Intelligence has reported that the Separatists have pulled back. Their base outside Pelic Baw is abandoned.
Yet return she has not.
Mace knotted his fingers together. Harun Kal is still nominally a Separatist planet, and she's a wanted woman. It won't be easy for her to get off-world, or even to signal for extraction. The local militia uses all kinds of signal jamming, and whatever they don't jam, they triangulate. Whole partisan bands have been wiped out by one incautious transmission.
Your friend she is. Care for her you do.
Mace didn't meet his eyes. His feeling for Deepa Balaba ran deep. She had been on world for 4 standard months. She couldn't communicate regularly. Mace had tracked her activities by sporadic Republic intelligence reports of sabotage at the Separatist starfighter base and the fruitless expeditions of the Balawai militias trying and failing to wipe out Deepa's guerrillas or even contain them. More than a month ago, Republic intelligence had sent word that the Separatists had pulled back to the Gavarno cluster because they could no longer maintain and defend their base. Her success could not have been more brilliant. But he feared to learn at what cost. But it can't simply be that she's missing, or... He felt Yoda's eyes on him still, and gave half an apologetic shrug. I was only thinking, if she'd been captured or killed, there would be no need for such secrecy. The creases on Yoda's face deepened around his mouth, and he made that sound of mild disapproval that every Jedi would instantly recognize.
Frivolous speculation is, when patience will reveal all.
Mace nodded silently. It's maddening, Master. If only, 10 years ago, we could have simply reached out.
Cling to the past. A Jedi cannot.
Yoda interrupted sternly. His green stare reminded Mace not to speak of the shadow that had darkened Jedi perception of the Force. This was not discussed outside the temple, not even here.
Member of the Jedi Council she is. Powerful Jedi. Brilliant warrior.
She'd better be. He tried to smile. I trained her.
But worry you do. Too much. Not only for Deepa, but for all the Jedi.
Supreme Chancellor Palpatine entered the room, accompanied by another man. Yoda stepped down from his hover chair. Mace rose in respect. The man with Palpatine was hardly larger than a boy, though clearly well past 40. Lank, thinning brown hair draped a face so thoroughly undistinguished that Mace could forget it the instant he glanced away. His eyes were red-rimmed, and he held a cloth handkerchief to his nose, and he looked so much like some minor bureaucratic functionary that Mace automatically assumed he was a spy. We have news of Deepa Balaba. This man has just come from Harun Kol. I'm afraid, well, perhaps you should simply examine the evidence for yourself. The agent opened a large travel case and produced an old-fashioned holoprojector. He spent a moment fiddling with controls, and then an image bloomed above the mirror-polished ebonite that served as Palpatine's desk. Mace's hands became fists. He couldn't seem to get his breath. The shimmering corpses were each the size of his finger. He counted 19. They looked human, or close to it. There was a scatter of prefabricated huts, blasted and burned and broken. The ruins of what must have once been a stockade wall made a ring around the scene. The jungle that surrounded them all stood 4 decimeters high and covered 1.5 meters of Palpatine's desk. After a moment, the agent sniffled apologetically. This is, seems to be, the work of loyalist partisans under the command of Master Balaba. A fist clenched in Mace's chest. That this soft little man, this civilian, could accuse Deepa Balaba of such an atrocity, even by implication, grabbed his heart with sick fury. But Mace had been a Jedi far too long for anger to gain an easy grip. A breath or two opened that fist around his heart, and he stood. I have seen nothing to indicate Deepa was involved. Master Windu, Palpatine began. What was the military value of this outpost? Military value? The agent looked startled. Why, none, I suppose. These were Balawai jungle prospectors. Some Japs operate as a kind of irregular militia, but irregulars are nearly always men. There were 6 women here. And Balawai militia units never bring their, children.
Children, Mace echoed.
The agent nodded reluctantly. 3. Bioscans indicate 1 girl about 12, the other 2 possibly fraternal twins, boy and a girl, about 9. Had to use bioscans. His sickly eyes asked Mace not to make him finish, because a few days in the jungle wouldn't have left enough of them to be identified any other way.
Mace said, I understand. These weren't militia, Master Windu. Just Balawide jungle prospectors in the wrong place at the wrong time. Jungle prospectors? Palpatine appeared politely interested. And what are Balawai?
Off-worlders, sir, Mace said. The jungles of Harun Kal are the galaxy's sole source of thistle bark, as well as Portak leaf, Jinsol, Tirun, and Lammas, among others.
Spices and exotic woods. And these are valuable enough to draw off-world emigrants into a war zone.
Have you priced thistle bark lately?
Palpatine smiled regretfully. I don't care for it, actually. I suppose my tastes are pedestrian. You can take a boy out of the midrim, but...
Mace shook his head. Not relevant, sir. My point. These were civilians. Deepa wouldn't be involved in something like this. She couldn't.
Hasty your statement is, Yoda said gravely. Seeing all evidence, I fear we have not.
Mace looked at the agent. The agent flushed again. Well, yes. Master Yoda is correct. This recording... He twitched his head around at the ghostly corpses that filled the office. Was made with the prospector's own equipment. It's adapted to Harun Kal work, where more sophisticated electronics...
I don't need a lesson on Harun Kal. Mace's voice went sharp. I need your evidence.
Yes, of course, Master Windu.
The agent fished in his travel case for a second or two, then came up with an old-fashioned data wafer of crystal.
It's audio only, but we've done voice match analysis. It's not exact, and there's some ambient noise, other voices, jungle sounds, that kind of thing, but we put match probability in the 90% range. Our station boss got a tip and sent me to check it out. I hired a steam crawler for some busted-out jups, rented a handful of townies who can handle heavy weapons, and crawled up there. What we found? Well, you can see it. Our sources are pretty sure the tip came from the ULF itself.
Palpatine glanced a question. Mace spoke without taking his eyes off the agent.
The Upland Liberation Front, sir. That's Deepa's partisan group. Uplanders is a rough translation of Koronai, the name the mountain tribes give themselves.
Koronai? Palpatine frowned absently. Aren't those your people, Master Windu?
My kin.
He made himself unclench his jaw.
Yes, sir. You have a good memory, sir.
A politician's trick.
Palpatine gave a gently self-deprecating smile and waved a dismissive hand.
Please go on.
The agent shrugged as though there was little more to tell.
There have been a lot of disturbing reports. Execution of prisoners, ambushes of civilians, on both sides. Usually they can't be verified. The jungle swallows everything. So when we got this tip...
You found this because somebody wanted you to find it. Mace finished for him. And now you think...
Mace turned the data wafer over and over through his fingers, watching it catch splinters of light.
You think those people might have been killed just to deliver this message?
What a hideous idea.
Palpatine lowered himself slowly onto the edge of his desk.
These ULF partisans, we ally ourselves with them? The Jedi ally with them? What sort of monsters are they?
I don't know.
Mace handed the wafer back to the agent.
Let's find out.
The agent slotted it into a port on the side of the holoprojector and touched a control.
The holoprojector's phased wave speakers brought the jungle around them to life with noise. Through the eddies and boils of sound drifted a whisper, sinuous as a river snake. A human or near-human whisper. A voice murmuring in basic. Sometimes comprehensible for a word here or phrase there. Sometimes twisting below the distorting ripples of the oral surface. Mace caught the words Jedi and knight or knife. And something about look between the stars. One whisper was entirely clear. He read the words on the datapad screen as the whisper seemed to come from just behind his shoulder.
I use the night, and the night uses me.
He forgot to breathe. This was bad. It got worse. The whisper strengthened to a voice. A woman's voice. Deepa's voice.
I have become... the darkness in the jungle.
The recording went on and on. Her murmur drained him of emotion, of strength, even of thought.
The longer she rambled, the emptier he got. Yet her final words still triggered a dull shock inside his chest.
I know you will come for me, Mace. You should never have sent me here, and I should never have come. But what's done can never be undone. I know you think I've gone mad, but I haven't. What's happened to me is worse. I've gone sane. That's why you'll come, Mace. That's why you'll have to. Because nothing is more dangerous than a Jedi who's finally sane.
Her voice trailed off into the jungle mutter. That's all there is. The agent extended a hesitant hand to the holoprojector and flicked a control. The jungle vanished like a bad dream. Mace spoke first.
She's right.
He lifted his head from his hands.
I have to go after her. Alone.
Palpatine's eyebrows twitched.
That seems, he murmured, unwise.
Concur with Chancellor Palpatine, I do,
Yoda said slowly.
Great risks there would be. Too valuable you are. Send others, we should.
There is no one else who can do this.
Surely, Master Windu.
Palpatine's smile was respectfully disbelieving.
A Republic intelligence covert ops team, or even a team of Jedi.
No. Mace rose and straightened his shoulders. It has to be me.
Please, we all understand your concern for your former student, Master Windu, but surely...
Reasons he must have, Supreme Chancellor, Yoda said. Listen to them, we should.
If Deepa has gone mad, or worse, fallen to the dark side, Mace began, it's vital that the Jedi know why, that we discover what did it to her. Until we know this, no more Jedi should be exposed to it than is absolutely necessary. She must be brought in, and soon, before rumor of such massacres reaches the wider galaxy.
Granted, she must be brought in, Palpatine allowed, but the question still remains. Why you?
Because she might not want to come, sir.
Palpatine looked thoughtful. Yoda's head came up, and his eyes opened, gleaming at the Supreme Chancellor.
If rogue she has gone, to find her difficult will be, to apprehend her.
His voice dropped, as though the words caused him pain.
Dangerous will be.
Deepa was my Padawan, Mace swallowed. If she must be stopped, I may be the only one who can do that, too.
Palpatine's eyebrows twitched polite incomprehension.
She is a master of the Vapad.
Vapad, Palpatine said. Eventually. Perhaps he'd grown tired of waiting for someone to explain. Isn't that some kind of animal?
A predator of Sarapin,
Yoda supplied gravely.
Also the nickname it is given by students for the seventh form of lightsaber combat.
I've always heard there are only six.
Six there were for generations of Jedi. The seventh is not well known. Powerful form it is. Deadliest of all. But dangerous it is, to its master as well as his opponent. Few have studied. One student alone to mastery has risen.
But if she's the only master, and this style is so deadly, what makes you think?
She's not the only master, sir.
Mace lifted his head to meet Palpatine's frown.
She is my only student to become a master.
Your only student? Palpatine echoed.
I didn't study the Vapad.
Mace let his hands fall to his sides.
I created it.
Ah, I see.
With respect, sir, I don't think you do.
I see enough to worry me, just a bit.
The warmth of his smile robbed insult from his words.
The relationship of master and Padawan is intense, you said, and I well believe it. When you faced your former master on Geonosis.
I prefer, Mace said softly. Not to talk about Geonosis, Chancellor.
Deepa Bilaba was your Padawan, and she is still perhaps your closest friend, is she not? If she must be slain, are you so certain you can strike her down?
May the Force grant, sir, Mace said slowly, that I will not have to find out.
Through the curved transparent steel, Harun Kaul was a wall of mountain-punched clouds beside him. It looked close enough to touch. The shuttle's orbit spiraled slowly toward the surface. Soon enough, he would be able to touch it in truth. The in-system shuttle was only a 20-seater, and even so, it was three-quarters empty. Mace Windu was the lone human. He sat as far from the others as the shuttle's limited space allowed. The Jedi Master wore clothing appropriate to his cover, a stained Corellian leather vest over a loose shirt that used to be white, and skin-tight black pants with wear patches of gray. The data pad on his lap was also a disguise, though it worked well enough for him to encrypt his journal on it. Most of it was actually a miniature subspace transmitter, frequency locked to the band monitored by the medium cruiser Holic, on station in the Ventrin system. The Coronal Highlands swung into view, a vast plateau of every conceivable shade of green, skirted by bottomless swirls of cloud, crisscrossed by interlocking mountain ranges. A few of the tallest peaks were capped in white. Many of the shorter mountains plumed billows of smoke and gas. The eastern half of the highland had already rolled through the Terminator. When the shuttle passed into the planet's shadow, gleams of dark red and orange specked the world like glowing coals, or predators' eyes beyond the ring of a campfire's light. Open caldery of the highland's many active volcanoes. It was beautiful. Mace barely noticed. He held the recording wand of the fake datapad near his mouth and spoke very, very softly.
From the private journals of Mace Windu. Initial Harun Kaul entry.
Deepa's down there. Right now. I shouldn't be thinking about this. I shouldn't be thinking about her. Not yet. But she's down there. She's been down there for months. I can't imagine what might have happened to her. I don't want to imagine. I'll find out soon enough. Focus. I have to focus. Concentrate on what I know is true while I wait for the mud to settle and the water to become clear. A lesson of Yoda's, but sometimes you can't wait. And sometimes the water never clears. I can focus on what I know about Harun Kaul. I know a lot. Here's some of it. Harun Kaul, sole planet of the Alhar system. Harun Kaul is the name given to it in the language of the indigenous human population, the Koronai, uplanders. It translates to basic as above the clouds. From space, the world appears to be oceanic, with only a few green-topped islands rising from a restless multicolored sea. But this is deceptive. The sea with which these islands punctuate is not liquid, but an ocean of heavier-than-air toxic gases which plume endlessly from the planet's innumerable active volcanoes. Only on the mountaintops and the high plateaus can oxygen-breathing life survive, and not on many of these, unless they rise far above the cloud sea. They are vulnerable to Harun Kaul's unpredictable winds. Its capital, Pelek Baw, population 435,000, is located on the sole inhabited landmass, the plateau known as the Coronal Highland, and is the largest permanent settlement on this primarily jungle-covered planet. The indigenous humans live in small, semi-nomadic tribal groups called Gosh, and avoid the settlements, which are maintained by off-worlders of a wide variety of species. The Koronai lump all off-worlders and settled folk under the somewhat contemptuous category of Balawai, down folk. I was born on Harun Kaul, far back in the highland. I am a full-blood Koran. 100 generations of my ancestors breathed that air and drank that water, ate the fruit of that soil, and were buried deep within it. I've returned only once, 35 standard years ago, but I have carried that world with me. But it is not home. Home is Coruscant. Home is the Jedi Temple. Deepa Bilaba came into my life by accident, one of those joyous coincidences that are sometimes the gift of the universe. I found her after I fought and killed the pirates who had murdered her parents. These pirates had kidnapped their victim's lovely infant daughter. She grew to girlhood in the temple, and to womanhood as my Padawan.
The proudest moment of my life was the day I stood and directed the Jedi Council to welcome its newest member. Deepa is more than a friend to me. She's one of those dangerous attachments. She is the daughter I will never have. The Republic was caught entirely unprepared. After 1,000 years of peace, no one, especially not we Jedi, truly believed civil war would ever come. This was the Confederacy's great advantage. The Separatists not only expected war, but counted on it. By the time the smoldering Clone War burst into Geonosian flame, their ships were already in motion. In the weeks that followed, while we Jedi tended our wounds and mourned our dead, while the Senate scrambled to assemble a fleet, any kind of fleet, to match the power of the Trade Federations, while Supreme Chancellor Palpatine pleaded and bargained and sometimes had to outright threaten wavering senators to not only stay loyal to the Republic, but to support the Grand Army with their credits and their resources, the Separatists had fanned out across the galaxy, seeding the hyperspace lanes with their forces. Strategically, it was a masterpiece. Any thrust into the core worlds of the Confederacy would be blunted and delayed long enough for Separatist reserves to engage it. Any attack with sufficient strength to swiftly overwhelm their pickets would leave hundreds or thousands of worlds uncovered to swift Separatist reprisal. Even before the Republic was ready to fight, we had lost. Yoda is the master strategist of the Jedi Council. A life as vast as his predisposes one to see the big picture and take the long view. He developed our current strategy of limited engagement on multiple fronts. Our goal is to harass the Separatists, wear them down in a war of attrition, chip away at them, and prevent them from consolidating their position. The Separatists don't enjoy unalloyed popularity, even in their core systems. And in any society, there are fringe elements eager to take up arms against authority. Jedi have been covertly inserted on hundreds of worlds with a common mission: to organize loyalist resistance, train partisans in sabotage and guerrilla warfare, and generally do whatever possible to destabilize the Separatist governments. This was why Deepa Balaba came to Harun Kaul. I sent her here. In the temple archives are reports of the Jedi anthropologists who study the Koronai tribes. They have a theory that a Jedi spacecraft may have made a forced landing there, perhaps thousands of years ago, during the turmoil of the Sith Wars, when so many Jedi were lost to history. There are several varieties of fungus native to the jungles of Harun Kaul that eat metals and silicates. A ship that could not lift off again immediately would be grounded forever, and comm equipment would be equally vulnerable. The ancestors of the Koronai, the anthropologists believe, were these shipwrecked Jedi. This is their best explanation for a curious genetic fact. All Koronai can touch the Force. The true explanation may be simpler. We have to. Those who cannot use the Force do not long survive. Humans can't live in those jungles. The Koronai survive by following their grasser herds. Grassers, great six-limbed behemoths, tear down the jungle with their forehands and their massive jaws. The name comes from the grassy meadows that are left in their wake. It is in those meadows that the Koronai make their precarious lives. The grassers protect the Koronai from the jungle. The Koronai, in turn, with their force-bonded companions, the fierce Ak-Dogs, protect the grassers. When the Jedi anthropologists were ready to depart, they had asked the elders of Gosh Windu if they might take with them a child to train in the Jedi arts and recover the Force talents of the Koronai to serve the peace of the galaxy. That would be me. I was an infant, an orphan, called by the name of my Gosh, for my parents had been taken by the jungle before my naming day. I was 6 months old. The choice was made for me. I've never minded. I could have chosen no better life.
The spaceport at Pelic Baw smelled clean. It wasn't. Typical backworld port. Filthy, disorganized, half-choked with rusted remnants of disabled ships. Mace stepped off the shuttle ramp and slung his kit bag by its strap. Smothering wet heat pricked sweat across his bare scalp. He raised his eyes from the ochre-scaled junk and discarded crumples of empty Nutripacks scattered around the landing deck, up into the misty jade sky. The white crown of Grandfather's shoulders soared above the city, the tallest mountain on the Coronal Highland, an active volcano with dozens of open caldery. Mace remembered the taste of the snow at the tree line, the thin cold air, and the aromatic resins of the evergreen scrub below the summit. He shouldered his kit bag and walked out into the blazing tropical afternoon. He passed under a dented rusty sign without looking up. The sign said, "Welcome to Pellick Ball." Faces. Hard faces, cold faces, hungry or drunk, hopeful, calculating, desperate. Street faces. Mace walked a pace behind and to the right of the Republic Intelligence Station boss, keeping his right hand near his holstered Mirsan Power 5. Late at night, the streets were still crowded. The Intel Station boss was a bulky, red-cheeked woman about Mace's age. She ran the Highland Green Washateria, a thriving laundry and public refresher station on the capital's north side. She never stopped talking. Mace hadn't started listening. The station boss's chatter somehow wandered onto the subject of the intel front she managed. The station boss's name was Flora Mirla Tank. "But call me Flora, sweetie. Everybody does." She'd already assembled a team to take him upcountry. 6 men with heavy weapons and an almost new steam crawler. "They look a little rough, but they're good boys, all of them. Freelancers, but solid." For security reasons, she explained, she was taking him to meet them herself. "Sooner you're on your way, happier we'll both be, right?" She stumped along the street, arms swinging. "You know this Jedi of yours is wanted, right? You got a way to get her off-world?" What Mace had was the Holic on station in the Ventrum system with 20 armed landers and a regiment of clone troopers. What he said was, "Yes." When a burst of blaster fire sang perhaps a block or two away, salted with staccato pops crisper than blaster hits, Floor instantly turned left and dodged away up the street.
"Whoops! This way! You want to keep clear of those little rumbles, you know. Might just be a food riot, but you never know. Those hand claps? Slug throwers, or I'm a dud."
The firing intensified. Voices joined in. Shouts and screams. Anger and pain. It started to sound less like a riot and more like a firefight. Just beyond the corner ahead, white-hot bolts flared past along the right-of-way. More blaster fire zinged behind them. The firefight was overflowing, becoming a flood that might surround them at any second. Mace looked back. Along this street, he still could see only crowds and ground cars, but the militia was starting to take an interest, checking weapons, trotting toward alleys and cross streets. Floor said behind him,
"See? Look at that. They're not even really aiming at anything. Now we just nip across."
She was interrupted by a splattering thwop. Mace had heard that sound too often. Steam, superheated by a high-energy particle beam, exploding through living flesh. A deep-tissue blaster hit. He turned back to Floor and found her staggering in a drunken circle, painting the pavement with her blood. Where her left arm should have been was only a fist-sized mass of ragged tissue. He dropped his kit bag and dove into the street. He rolled, coming up to slam her hip joint with his shoulder. The impact folded her over him. He lifted her, turned, and sprang back for the corner. Bright flares of blaster bolts bracketed invisible sizzles and finger snaps of hypersonic slugs. He reached the meager cover of the corner and lay her flat on the sidewalk, tucked close against the wall.
"This isn't supposed to happen."
Her life was flooding out the shattered stump of her shoulder. In the force, Mace could feel her shredded brachial artery. With the force, he reached inside her shoulder to pinch it shut. The flood trickled to sluggish welling. Boots clattered on permacrete behind him. A militia squad sprinted toward them.
"You, Corno, stand away from that woman."
He glanced back. 6 of them, firing stance. The light pole at their backs haloed black shadow across their faces. Plasma-charred muzzles stared at him.
"This woman is wounded, badly. Without medical attention, she will die."
"You're no doctor," one said, and shot him.
He had plenty of time to get familiar with the interrogation room. 4 meters by three, duracrete blocks flecked with gravel whose shear planes glinted like mica. The walls from waist high to ceiling had once been painted the color of aged ivory. The floor and lower walls used to be the green block of wander kelp. What was left of both paint jobs flaked in patches rimmed with mildew. The binder chair that held him was in better condition. The door was behind him, twisting to watch it hurt too much. He waited. He waited a long time. He was thirsty. Uneasy pressure in his bladder somehow made his head hurt worse. He felt the door behind him open. A damp breeze licked the back of his neck. Footsteps entered and clicked to one side, and he twisted to look. They belonged to a smallish human male, comfortably plump, wearing militia khakis that were improbably well-starched, considering the heat and the damp. The man carried a snap-rim case, covered in tanned animal hide. "No, please." He waved a hand toward the door. "Feel free to have a look." Twisting further, Mace could see down the corridor behind his binder chair. At the far end stood a pair of steady-looking militiamen with blaster rifles aimed at his face. Mace frowned. An unusual position for guards. "Is this clear enough?" The man moved around Mace to the table, never crossing their line of fire, and opened his animal hide bag. "I'm told you have a bit of a concussion. Let's not make it fatal, shall we?" The Force showed Mace a dozen places on that soft body where a single blow would maim or kill. This man was no warrior, but energy spidered outward from him in all directions. An important man. Mace found no direct threat in him, only a cheery pragmatism. "My name's Gepton. I'm chief of security for the Capital District. My friends call me Lors. You can call me Colonel Gepton." He waited, still wearing that indifferently pleasant smile. After a few seconds, he sighed. "Well, we know who I am, and we know who you're not." He flipped open the lid of Mace's identikit. "You're not Kinsel Trapano. I'm guessing not Corellian, either. Interesting history you don't have. Smuggler, small-time pirate, gunrunner, etc. and so forth." He settled into the wooden chair, laced his fingers together, and propped his hands on his belly. He watched Mace with that pleasant smile, silently, waiting for him to say something.
"What am I charged with?"
"Nothing's been filed. Yet."
"Then why am I being held?"
"We're interrogating you." Mace raised an eyebrow.
"Oh yes, we are," Gepton winked. "We are indeed. I'm a terrific interrogator."
"You haven't even asked me a question."
Gepton smiled like a sleepy vine cat.
"Questions are inefficient.
In your case, futile."
"You must be good indeed to have figured that out without even asking one."
By way of reply, Gepton reached into the animal skin case and pulled out Mace's lightsaber. He hefted it in his hand, smiling.
"And torture would probably be a waste of time too, yes?"
Mace measured him again.
"Gepton could be a Corran name."
"And in fact it is," Gepton admitted cheerily.
"My paternal grandfather came out of the jungle some 70-odd years ago. This is not discussed, you understand. Not in polite society."
"What do you want from me?"
"Well, that's the real question, isn't it? Here I have a Jedi, probably an important Jedi, since we caught him next to the corpse of the planetary chief of Republic Intelligence."
He winked at Mace again.
"Oh, yes. Flora Mirla and I were old friends. Friends too long to let political differences come between us, eh?"
"If your men hadn't stunned me, she'd still be alive."
Gepton chuckled.
"If my men hadn't stunned you, I wouldn't have the pleasure of your company tonight."
Gepton shifted his weight like a man getting comfortable after a large meal.
"So, back to this Jedi in question. I fell to wondering if your business might possibly have something to do with another Jedi, one who seems to be running around upcountry, doing all sorts of un-Jedi-ish kinds of things, like murdering civilians. Might your business have something to do with her?"
"If it does?"
Gepton tilted his chair back and looked at Mace over the curves of his plump cheeks. We've been hunting this Jedi for some time now. I've even posted a bounty, a big bounty. It's possible that if someone were to, deal with my existing Jedi problem, I might feel fully compensated.
I see.
Maybe you do, and maybe you don't. Here's the thing. I can't quite make up my mind. I'd like that reward. Yes, indeed I would. But given the choice, I'd prefer my, upcountry Jedi problem taken care of. But I'm not sure that's the best decision I could make right now. For my future. I'm wavering, you see. Teetering. I need a little reassurance, if you know what I mean.
Now Mace finally understood what they were talking about.
How much reassurance do you need?
Gepton's eyes glinted the same flat sheen as the shear planes of the gravel in the walls.
10,000.
I'll give you 4.
Gepton scowled at him.
I can keep you here a very long time.
May said,
3,500.
You insult me. What? Am I not worth even haggling with?
We are haggling. 3,250.
I'm wounded, Master Jedi.
You mean Jedi Master, May said. 3,000.
Gepton's face blackened, but after a moment wasted trying to match uncompromising stares with Mace Windu, a losing proposition, he shook his head and shrugged again.
3,000. I suppose one must make allowances, he sighed.
There is a war on, after all.
They cut him loose at dawn. Mace descended the worn stone sweep of the Ministry of Justice's front steps. The high cirrus over Grandfather's shoulder bled mourning. He slid into the crowd and let its current carry him along. Endless faces passed him, meeting his eyes incuriously or not at all. He could not guess what he should do next. Mace felt a "Hey, buddy" nudge on the shoulder and looked around to find no one there. The nudge had come through the Force. He scanned a sea of faces and heads in steam crawler smoke, limp cafe banners dripping in the moist air, a cart with a ragged mange-patched grasser in the traces. Another nudge. Mace got a glimpse of him this time. The crowd made one of those smoke-random rifts that let him see 100 meters along the street. A slender Corrin, half Mace's age or less, darker skin, wearing the brown, close-woven tunic and pants of a jungle Goshen. Mace caught a quick flash of white teeth and a hint of startling blue eyes, and then the young Corrin turned and moved away up the street. Those startling eyes.
Had Mace seen him before?
On the street last night, maybe. Around the time of the riot.
Mace went after him.
The young Corrin clearly wanted him to follow. Each time the crowds would close between them and Mace would lose him, another Force nudge would draw his eyes. Sometimes when the Corrin flicked a glance back, Mace thought he might detect a hint of a smile, but he was too far away to read it. Was that smile encouraging, friendly, merely polite, malicious, predatory? The Corrin turned down a narrower, darker street, still shadowed with the lees of night. Here the crowds had given way to a pair of Yarkora sleeping off their evening's debauchery arm in arm, perilously close to a pool of vomit, and 3 or 4 aging Balawai women who had ventured out to sweep the walkstones in front of their respective tenement doorways. Now off the main streets and away from the constant rumble of voice, foot, and wheel, he could hear a new sound in the morning, faint but crisp. A thin, sharp hum that pulsed irregularly, bobbing like a cup on a lazy sea. Repulsor lift engine, maybe more than one.
On the opposite sides of the buildings around, he thought. Pacing me. Maybe swoops, maybe speeder bikes.
He followed Smiley through a maze of streets that twisted and forked. Some were loud and thronged. Most were quiet, giving out no more than muttered conversation and the thutter of polymer cycle tires. The twisting streets became tangled alleys. One more corner, and Smiley was gone. Mace found himself in a tiny courtyard, maybe 5 meters square. In some languages, a place like this is called a dead end. A perfect place for a trap. Mace thought, finally. He'd begun to wonder if they'd changed their minds. He stood in the dead end, his back to the straight length of alley, and opened his mind. In the Force, they felt like energy fields. Four spheres of cautious malice layered with anticipated thrill, expecting a successful hunt, but taking no chances. Two hung back at the far mouth of the alley to provide cover and reserves. The other two advanced silently with weapons leveled, going for the point-blank shot. Mace could feel the aim points of their weapons skittering hotly across his skin like Aradusian lava beetles under his clothes. The repulsor lift hum sharpened and took on a direction, above to either side. Speeder bikes, he guessed. This was about to get interesting. Mace felt only a warm anticipation. After a day of uncertainty and pretense, of holding onto his cover and offering bribes, he was looking forward to doing a little straightforward, uncomplicated butt-whipping. With rigorous mental discipline, he squashed his anticipation and decided to parley. Talking them out of attacking might save their lives, and they seemed to be professionals. Perhaps he could simply pay for the information he wanted, instead of beating it out of them. But as he reached his decision, the men behind him reached their range. Professionals indeed. Without a word, they leveled their weapons, and twin packets of galvaned plasma streaked at his spine. In even the best-trained human shooter, there is at least a quarter-second delay between the decision to fire and the squeeze on the trigger. Deep in the Force, Mace could feel their decision even before it was made, an echo from his future. Before their fingers could so much as twitch, he was moving. By the time the blaster bolts were a quarter of their way there, Mace had whirled, the speed of his spin opening his vest. By the time the bolts were halfway there, the Force had snapped his lightsaber into his palm. At three quarters, his blade extended, and when the blaster bolts reached him, they met not flesh and bone, but a meter-long continuous cascade of vivid purple power. Mace reflexively slapped the bolts back at the shooters, but instead of rebounding from his blade, the bolts splattered through it and grazed his ribs and burst against the trash bin behind him so that it boomed and bucked and shivered like a cracked bell. Mace thought, I might be in trouble after all. Before the thought could fully form in his mind, the two shooters, a distant calculating part of Mace's brain, instantly filed that they were both human, had flipped their weapons to auto-burst. A blinding spray of bolts filled the alleyway. Mace threw himself sideways, flipping in the air. A bolt clipped his shin, hammering his leg backward, turning his flip into a tumble, but he still managed to land in a crouch behind the cover of the alley's inner corner. He glanced at his leg. The bolt hadn't penetrated his boot leather. Stun setting, he thought. Professionals who want me alive. While he was trying to feel his way toward what they might try next, he noticed that his blade cast a peculiarly pale light. Much too pale. Even as he crouched there, staring drop-jawed into the paling shaft, it faded, flickered, and winked out. His lightsaber was out of charge. That's not possible, he snarled. It's not. With a lurch in his guts, he got it. Gepton. Mace had underestimated him. Corrupt and greedy, yes. Stupid? Obviously not. Jedi! A man's voice from the alley, one of the shooters. Let's do this the easy way, huh? Nobody has to get hurt. If only that were true, Mace thought. We got all kinds of stuff out here, Jedi. Not just blasters. We got Glop, we got Nighty-Night, we got stun nets. But they hadn't used any yet. Mercenaries, Mace decided. You want to know what else we got? Mace could hear his smirk. Look up, Jedi. Over the roof rims above, the pair of speeder bikes bobbed upward, visored pilots skylining themselves against the blue. Their underslung blaster cannons bracketed Mace with plasma-scorched muzzles. He was completely exposed to their crossfire, but they weren't firing. Mace nodded to himself. They wanted him alive. But that didn't mean those cannons were useless. A blast from the lead bike shattered a chest-sized hunk of the baked clay wall 2 meters above him. Chunks and slivers pounded him and slashed him and battered him to the ground. Heat trickled down his skin, and he smelled blood.
He was cut. The rest was too fresh to know how bad it might be. He scrambled through the rubble and dove behind a trash bin. No help there. The speeder pilot blasted the bin's far side, and it slammed Mace hard enough to knock his wind out. Shot, concussed, cut, battered, bladeless.
All right.
He reached up and splayed his hands above the trash bin so that the speeder pilot could see.
All right, I'm coming out. Don't shoot.
The lead speeder drifted in a little as he worked his way out from behind the bin, hands high. The other hung back for high cover.
The two shooters slowly uncovered, one from behind a dumpster and the other stepping out from a recessed doorway. The two backups stayed at the corners of the alley's far mouth.
You're pretty good, May said. Among the best I've ever seen.
Hey, thanks, one answered. From his voice, this was the one who'd spoken earlier. The leader, then, most likely.
Let's have that blaster, eh? Nice and easy.
Slowly, very slowly, May switched his lightsaber to his left hand and moved his right down toward the Power Five's butt.
I wish I could tell you how many times teams like yours have come after me. Not just in alleys, on the street, caves, cliffs, freighter holds, dry washes, you name it.
And now you're caught. Put the blaster on the ground and kick it toward my friend here.
The silent one bent down for the Power Five. His carbine's muzzle dropped out of line. Mace took a step to his left. Now the talker was in the line of fire from the two behind him.
Now the lightsaber, the talker said.
Sure.
Mace tossed it toward him.
Take it.
His lightsaber tumbled through a long arc. In the force, he felt them all fractionally relax. The slightest easing of trigger pressure, the tiniest shift of adrenaline-charged concentration. They relaxed because he was now unarmed. Because none of them understood what a lightsaber is. A lightsaber is not a weapon. Weapons may be taken or destroyed. Weapons are unitary entities. His lightsaber reflected all he knew. All he believed, all he was. Which was why it required no effort, no thought, to seize his lightsaber's tumbling hand grip through the force and fire it like a bullet. It screamed through the air, and its butt took the talker between the eyes with a hollow stone-on-wood whack. The impact flipped him off his feet, unconscious or dead before he hit the ground. His hand spasmed on the blaster carbine, and it gushed energy. Through the force, Mace nudged the carbine's muzzle to sweep the talker's partner and blow him spinning to the ground. Mace guided it further upward, and hammering energy chewed an arc of chunks from the walls before it battered the control vanes of the speeder bike above and behind him, smacking it into a spin that kept the pilot too busy hanging on to even think about firing a weapon. The over-unders of the two at the alley mouth now coughed, but Mace was already in motion. He force sprang at a slant and met the far wall 5 meters up, then kicked higher and across to the opposite wall, up and back again, zigzagging toward the rooftops through a storm of blaster fire. Belated grenades burst below, spit-white glop spewed across the alley, swirling the purple cloud of nighty-night anesthetic gas, but Mace was already well above their effect zone. He sailed up over the lip of the flat baked tile roof. And there were people up here. The roof was cluttered with hods full of tiles and pots of liquid permacite and bundled tarpaulins that might have been keeping the winter rains out, but now had become camouflage for at least 2 men. Lying concealed beneath the tarps, the men were invisible to the eye, but Mace felt them in the force. Adrenaline shivers and the desperate self-control it took to remain motionless. Before he could touch down, the other speeder pilot cut off his path with a fountain of blaster fire that traversed back to intercept him. A shove with the force dropped him short, but as he made contact with the roof, the pilot fired an impact-fused grenade at Mace's feet. Mace reached out, and the force slapped the grenade away from himself and the hidden men. But the cannon's blast stream hammered a line of shattered tiles and smoking holes in the rooftop straight at them. So he sprang toward it. An upward thrust with the force lifted him over the blast stream, and he made a spring into a twisting dive roll that brought him to his feet with his back to the massive communal chimney that rose from the center of the roof. The chimney was only a meter taller than Mace was. He sprang to the top. Cannon fire blasted into its baked dirt wall, tracking up toward his legs. Before he could spot a roof hole big enough to dive through, the chimney bucked and began to crumble. He clawed for his balance. A man shouted,
"Hey, Windu! Happy Naaman Day!"
And Mace got a glimpse of tarpaulin slipping back, and blue eyes and white teeth, and something came tumbling toward him through the air. It was a lightsaber. It was Deepa's lightsaber. Energy crackled and fountained from the crystal. In the green flash of Deepa's blade, the situation looked different. The rest of the fight lasted less than 5 seconds. The speeder bike above opened fire again, and Mace slipped to one side, letting the force move the blade. Blaster bolts ricocheted from the energy fountain and smashed the bike's power cell, sending it flipping toward the ground within the alley. The blue-eyed Corrin, it was Smiley, and the other man who had lain beneath the tarp held rapid-fire slug throwers that they slipped over the roof rim to fill the alley below with a lethal swarm of bullets. Two more Corrinite popped out of cover on the rooftop across the alley. One had a slug thrower. Flame leaped from its barrel. The other, a big, light-skinned Corrin girl with reddish hair, stood upright, wide-legged, a massive Mirsan thunderbolt tucked into her armpit, showering the alley with howling packets of galvaned particle beam. The other speeder pilot didn't like the new odds. He power-slewed his speeder and shrieked away above the rooftops. Smiley yanked his barrel around and took aim at the pilot's back. But before he could fire, the speeder bike flipped in the air, tumbled out of control, and crashed through the wall of a distant building at roughly 200 kilometers per hour. Smiley waved a hand, and the Corrinite stopped firing. The sudden silence rang in Mace's ears.
"Was that fun or what?"
Smiley grinned at Mace and winked.
"Come on, Windu. Tell me that didn't warm your shorts a little."
Mace dropped to the rooftop and angled Deepa's blade to a neutral position. "Who are you?"
"I'm the guy who just slipped your jiffies off the roaster. Let's go, man. Militia'll be here any minute."
Smiley took a rope in his hands and beckoned.
"I'm the double, Windu. What do you want, an invitation? Flowers and a box of candy?"
The cascade of Deepa's lightsaber highlighted both their faces the color of sunlight in the jungle.
"What I want," Mace told him, "is for you to tell me what you were doing with this blade."
"The lightsaber?"
The blue in his eyes sparked with manic fire.
"That's my credentials," he said.
Pellic Ball rolled past the ground car's tinted windows. The driver was local, a middle-aged Corrin with a web of cataract across one eye and bad teeth stained red from chewing raw thistle bark. Mace and the Corrinite sat behind him in the passenger cabin. The first thing the Corrinite did once they were on their way was swiftly and efficiently field-strip the captured weapons, despite the cramped compartment and the jouncing ride. Mace guessed they must have had plenty of practice. All exposed parts, they rubbed with chunks of a translucent orange-brown resin that Smiley said was Portak amber, a natural fungicide that the ULF used to protect their weapons. This was the same resin that coated the hand grip of Deepa's lightsaber. Smiley's name was Nick Rostu. He'd introduced himself in the ground car while he was spray bandaging Mace's cuts and treating his bruises by a liberal use of the stolen, captured medpack. Unlike his companions, Nick spoke basic without an accent, and he knew his way around the city, probably why he seemed to be in charge. The big, emotionally ravaged girl they called Chalk. The other two looked enough alike to be brothers. The older, whose teeth showed scarlet thistle stains, was called Lesh. The younger brother, Besh, never spoke. A knurl of scar joined the corner of his mouth to his right ear, and his left hand was missing its last three fingers. In the ground car, they spoke to each other in Korun. Mace could trust none of them. Though he felt no malice from them, he'd felt none from Gempton either. But he did feel knotted around them, a strangling web of anger and fear and pain.
"I think we'll all speak basic now," Mace said.
"Pretty free with the orders, aren't we?"
Nick said.
"Who said you're in charge?"
"I won't bore you with the complexities of chain of command," Mace said. "I'll stick to facts, simple facts, straightforward, easy to understand. Like this one. Master Balaba sent you here to bring me to her."
"Says who?"
"If she wanted me dead, you'd have left me in that alley. You're under orders to deliver me.
Deepa doesn't exactly give orders, Nick said. It's more like she just lets you know what she thinks you should do, and then you do it.
May shrugged. Do you intend to disappoint her? The uncertain looks they now exchanged drove that sick knife deeper into Mace's guts. They feared her, or something to do with her, in a way that they did not fear him. Nick said,
So?
So you need my cooperation. Mace checked the meter on the blaster pack he was using to recharge his lightsaber. This one was depleted. He pulled the adapter out of his lightsaber's charge port. Nick sat forward, a dangerous glint sparking in his blue eyes.
Who says we need your cooperation? Who says we can't just pack you up and send you Jedi-free delivery?
Instead of hooking in the next blaster pack, Mace balanced the lightsaber's hand grip on his palm. I do. Another glance made the rounds, and Mace felt swift currents ripple the force back and forth between them. The brothers blanched. Chalk's knuckles whitened on the Thunderbolt light repeater. Nick's face went perfectly blank. Their hands shifted on their rifles. Mace hefted the lightsaber. Reconsider. He watched each of them mentally calculate the odds of bringing a weapon to bear in the cramped cabin before he could trigger his blade. Your chances come in two shapes, he said. Slim and fat.
Okay. Nick carefully lifted empty hands. Okay, everybody, stand down. Relax, huh? Shee, how twitchy are we, huh? Listen, you need us too, Windu. I mean, you're not from around here.
I was born on the north slope of Grandfather's shoulder.
Yeah, okay, sure, I know you're from here, but you're still not from here. You're from the galaxy. Things are different here, you understand?
I understand, Mace said heavily, that you're not my only option for local guides. Republic Intelligence set up a team to take me upcountry. The looks exchanged between the Corps and I stopped Mace in mid-sentence.
Who do you think we left dead in that alley just now?
Mace stared. Nick showed him those gleaming teeth of his. Mace looked at Lesh. Lesh spread his hands.
Does talk true, Nick. Things are different here.
Bess shrugged, nodding. Mace looked at Chalk, at her eyes, incongruously dark in her fair-skinned face, at the way she cradled the massive Mirsan Thunderbolt on her lap, as though it was her child. And many things suddenly fell into place. It was you, he said to her wonderingly. You shot Flora Mirla Tenk. The blistering afternoon sun dissolved the departing ground car into heat shimmer and dust. Mace stood in the road and watched it go. This far from the capital, the road was little more than a pair of ruts filled with crushed rock that snaked through the hills. They were well above the capital now, on the far side of the Great Mountain. Nick and the others were already hiking uphill through an ankle-high litter of bracken and scrub, weapons slung across their shoulders. The living wall of the jungle loomed 20 meters above. In the far distance, Mace could just make out a segmented line of gray blotches, probably tame grassers.
Master Windu!
Nick had stopped on the hillside above. He beckoned for Mace to follow and pointed at the sky.
Air patrols! We need to make the tree line!
Single file through the jungle. Chalk picked their path, parting gleam bronze, tipping grip-leaf trailers aside with the muzzle of the Thunderbolt. Mace followed perhaps 10 meters back, with Nick close behind his shoulder. Besh and Lesh brought up the rear together, switching positions from time to time, covering each other. Mace had to look sharp to keep track of Chalk. Once they were well into the jungle, Mace could no longer easily feel any of the Coronai in the force. Nor could he easily pick them out with ordinary senses. Some subtle force trick gave his gaze a tendency to slip aside from them and to pass over them without seeing unless he firmly directed his will. They broke out into a gap, and Nick called a halt. Chalk moved into the middle of the gap, lowered her head, and went entirely still. A force wave passed out from her and broke across Mace, and 35 years fell away. For a delicious instant, Mace was once more a boy, returned to the company of Gosh Windu after a lifetime in the Jedi Temple.
feeling for the first time the silken warmth of a Corrin's force call to an Ack. Within minutes, a crashing outside the gap heralded the arrival of large beasts, and soon the jungle wall parted to admit a grasser. It lumbered into the gap on its hind legs, its four anterior limbs occupied with ripping down greenery and stuffing it into a mouth large enough to swallow Mace whole. It chewed placidly, bovine contentment in all three of its eyes. Three more grassers tore their way into the gap. All four were harnessed for riding, the wide saddles cinched above and below their foreshoulders, exactly as Mace remembered. One wore a dual saddle setup, the secondary saddle slung reversed at the beast's mid-shoulder. Nick reached up to take the knotted mounting rope of the dual-saddled grasser.
Come on, Master Windu. You're riding with me.
Where are your axe?
Around. Can't you feel them?
And now Mace could. A ring of predatory wariness outside the green walls. Savagery and hunger and devotion tangled into a semi-sentient knot of let's find something to kill. Nick rope-walked up the flank of the grasser and slid into the upper saddle.
You'll see them if you need to see them. Let's hope you don't.
Is it no longer customary to introduce a guest to the axe of the Gosh?
Without even understanding why he did it, Mace moved away into the middle of the gap. One breath composed his mind. The next expressed his nature into the force around him. Jedi serenity balancing buried temper. Devotion to peace tipping the scales against a guilty pleasure in fighting. Nothing was hidden here. Light and dark, pure and corrupt, hope, fear, pride and humility. He offered up everything that made him who he was, with friendly smile and lowered eye and hands open at his sides. Then he sent rippling through the force the call he'd been taught 35 years before, and he got an answer. Slipping through the walls of the gap, measured tread blending seamlessly with wind rustle and insect buzz. Horned reptoid heads questing, lidless oval eyes of gleaming black.
Windu!
A hiss from Nick.
Don't move!
Triangular fangs scissored along each other as jaws that could crush Durasteel worked and chewed. Steaming drool trailed down mouthfolds of scaled hide thick enough to stop a lightsaber. Splay-toed feet with shovel-sized claws churned kilos of soil with every step. Muscular armored tails, as long as their landspeeder-sized bodies, whipped sinuously back and forth. The Ackdogs of Harun Kal. Three of them. They circled, switching tails that could break Mace in half. Their eyes, hard-shelled and lidless, glittered without expression. Nick stared down at Mace from 3 meters above the jungle floor.
Don't just stand there!
All right. Mace lifted his hands and all three Ackdogs lay down. A touch on the force and a turn of both palms and the three dogs rolled onto their backs, black tongues lolling to the side between razor-sharp teeth. They panted happily, gazing at him with absolute trust. Nick said something about dipping himself in Tusker poop. Mace moved to one dog's head, sliding the palm of his hand between the triangle that 6 vestigial horns formed on the axe brow. His other hand he placed just beside the axe lower lip, so that the creature's huge tongue could flick Mace's scent into the olfactory pits beside his nostrils. He moved from one to the next, and then to the last. They took his scent, and he took their force field. With the severe formality such solemn occasions demand, they respectfully learned each other.
All right, Mace said, to everyone and no one. I'm ready to go.
Every night, they made a cold camp. No fire and no need for one. The axe would keep predators at bay, and the Corps and I did not mind the darkness. Though militia gunships did not fly at night, a campfire was enough hotter than the surrounding jungle that it could be detected by satellite sensors. Nick explained dryly that you never know when the Balawai might decide to drop a Dokaw on your head. He said that the government still had an unknown number of Dokaw platforms in orbit, The deorbiting kinetic anti-emplacement weapons were basically just missile-sized rods of solid durasteel with rudimentary guidance and control systems set in orbit around the planet. Not too accurate, but then it didn't have to be. A meteorite strike on demand. For the Coronae, campfires were a thing of the past. They would sit or kneel on the ground, sharing their meals. Once the food squares and candy they'd looted from the dead men ran out, their meals became strips of smoked grasser meat and a hard, cave-edged cheese made from raw grasser milk. Mace learned a great deal about these young Coronae, and, by implication, about the ULF, during these nights in camp. Nick was the leader of this little band, but not by any reason of rank. They didn't seem to have ranks. Nick led by force of personality and by lightning use of his acid wit, like a jester in control of a royal court. Lesh and Besh were in the war from stark hatred of the Balawai. A couple of years before, Besh had been kidnapped by jungle prospectors. His missing fingers had been cut off, one at a time, by the Balawai, to force him to answer questions about the location of a supposed treasure grove of Lammas trees. When he could not answer these questions, in fact, the treasure grove was only a myth, they assumed he was just stubborn. "If you won't answer us," one had said, "we'll make sure you never answer anyone else either." Besh never spoke because he couldn't. The Balawai had cut out his tongue. Chalk proved a surprise to Mace. Guessing what he had of what had happened to her, he expected that she would be fighting out of a personal vendetta, not unlike Lesh and Besh. On the contrary, even before joining the ULF, she and some members of her gosh had hunted down the men who'd molested her, a 5-man squad of regular militia and their non-com, and given them the traditional Korin punishment for such crimes. This was called Tan Peltrukal, which roughly translates as jungle justice. The guilty men were kidnapped, spirited away 100 kilometers from the nearest settlement, then stripped of equipment, clothing, food, everything, and released, naked, in the jungle. Very, very few men had ever survived Tan Peltrukal. These didn't. So Chalk did not fight for revenge. In her own words, "Tough girl me, big, strong, good fighter. Didn't want to be, had to be."
"I am impressed by how you move through the jungle," May said to her once, in one of these cold camps. "It's not easy to see you, even when I know you're there. Even your grasser is hard to track." She grunted, chewing bark.
Her dismissive shrug was about as casual as Mace's question. That is, not very.
"That's an interesting way of using..."
He dredged from the depths of his 35-year-old memory the Korun word for the Force.
"Pelikotan. Roughly, world power. Using Pelikotan. Is this something you've always been able to do?"
What Mace was really asking, what he was afraid to ask outright... Did Deepa teach you that?
If she was teaching Jedi skills to people who were too old to learn Jedi discipline, people with no defense against the dark side.
"You don't use Pelikotan," Chalk said. "Pelikotan uses you."
This was not a comforting answer. Mace recalled that the strict, literal translation of the word was jungle mind. He discovered that he didn't really want to think about it. In his head, he kept hearing,
"I have become the darkness in the jungle."